Crouch End. By the time the woman had finally gone, it was nearly 2:30 in the morning. Outside the Crouch End police station, Tottenham Lane was a small, dead river. London was asleep. But London never sleeps deeply, and its dreams are uneasy. P.C. Vetter closed his notebook, which he'd almost filled as the American woman's strange, frenzied story poured out. He looked at the typewriter and the stack of blank forms on the shelf beside it. "This one'll look odd, come morning light," he said. P.C. Farnham was drinking a Coke. He didn't speak for a long time. "She was American, wasn't she?" he said finally, as if that might explain most or all of the story she had told. "It'll go in the back file," Vetter agreed, and looked around for a cigarette. "But I wonder..." Farnham laughed.
"You don't mean you believe any part of it? Go on, mate, Bob's your uncle."
"I didn't say that, did I?" "No, but you're new here."
Farnham sat a little straighter. He was 27, and it was hardly his fault that he had been posted here from Muswell Hill to the north, or that Vetter, who was nearly twice his age, had spent his entire uneventful career in the quiet London backwater of Crouch End.
"Perhaps so, sir," he said. "But, with respect, mind, I still think I know a swatch of the old whole cloth when I see one. Or hear one."
"Give us a fag, mate," Vetter said, looking amused. "There, what a good boy you are."
He lit it with a wooden match from a bright red railway box, shook it out, and tossed the match stub into Farnham's ashtray. He peered at the lad through a haze of drifting smoke. His own days of laddie good looks were long gone. Betty's face was deeply lined, and his nose was a map of broken veins. He liked his six of harp a night, did P.C. Vetter.
"You think Crouch End's a very quiet place, then, do you?"
Farnham shrugged. In truth, he thought Crouch End was a big suburban yawn, what his younger brother would have been pleased to call a fucking boratorium.
"Yes," Vetter said, "I see you do. And you're right. Goes to sleep by 11 most nights, it does. But I've seen a lot of strange things in Crouch End. If you're here half as long as I've been, you'll see your share too. There are more strange things happen right here in this quiet 6 or 8 blocks than anywhere else in London. That's saying a lot, I know. But I believe it. It scares me. So I have my lager, and then I'm not so scared. You look at Sergeant Gordon sometime, Farnham, and ask yourself why his hair is dead white at 40. Or I'd say, take a look at Petty. But you can't very well, can you? Petty committed suicide in the summer of 1976, our hot summer. It was..."
Vetter seemed to consider his words.
"It was quite bad that summer. Quite bad. There were a lot of us who were afraid they might break through."
"Who might break through what?"
Farnham asked. He felt a contemptuous smile turning up the corners of his mouth, knew it was far from politic, but was unable to stop it. In his way, Vetter was raving as badly as the American woman had. He had always been a bit queer. The booze, probably. Then he saw Vetter was smiling right back at him.
"You think I'm a dotty old prat, I suppose," he said.
"Not at all, not at all,"
Farnham protested, groaning inwardly.
"You're a good boy," Vetter said. "Won't be riding a desk here in the station when you're my age. Not if you stick on the force. Will you stick, do you think? Do you fancy it?"
"Yeah,"
Farnham said. It was true. He did fancy it. He meant to stick, even though Sheila wanted him off the police force and somewhere she could count on him. The Ford assembly line, perhaps. The thought of joining the wankers at Ford curdled his stomach.
"I thought so," Vetter said, crushing his smoke. "Gets in your blood, doesn't it? You could go far, too, and it wouldn't be boring old Crouch End you'd finish up in, either. Still, you don't know everything. Crouch End is strange. You ought to have a peek in the back file sometime, Farnham. Oh, a lot of it's the usual. Girls and boys run away from home to be hippies or punks or whatever it is they call themselves now. Husbands gone missing. And when you clap an eye to their wives, you can most times understand why. Unsolved arsons, purse snatchings, all of that. But in between, there's enough stories to curdle your blood, and some to make you sick to your stomach.
True word.
Better nodded. Some of them very like the one that poor American girl just told us.
Oh, she'll not see her husband again. Take my word for it.
He looked at Farnham and shrugged. Believe me, believe me not.
It's all one, isn't it?
The file's there. We call it the open file because it's more polite than the back file or the kiss my arse file.
Study it up, Farnham. Study it up.
Farnham said nothing, but he actually did intend to study it up. The idea that there might be a whole series of stories, such as the one the American woman had told, that was disturbing.
Sometimes, Better said, stealing another of Farnham's silk cuts, I wonder about dimensions.
Dimensions?
Yes, my good old son. Dimensions. Science fiction writers are always on about dimensions, aren't they?
Ever read science fiction, Farnham?
No, Farnham said. He had decided this was some sort of elaborate leg pull.
What about Lovecraft? Ever read anything by him?
Never heard of him, Farnham said. The last fiction he'd read for pleasure, in fact, had been a small Victorian-era pastiche called Two Gentlemen in Silk Knickers.
Well, this fellow Lovecraft was always writing about dimensions, Better said, producing his box of railway matches. Dimensions close to ours, full of these immortal monsters that would drive a man mad at one look. Frightful rubbish, of course. Except, whenever one of these people straggles in, I wonder if all of it was rubbish. I think to myself then, when it's quiet and late at night, like now, that our whole world, everything we think of as nice and normal and sane, might be like a big leather ball filled with air. Only in some places, the leather's scuffed almost down to nothing. Places where the barriers are thinner. Do you get me?
Yes,
Farnham said, and thought, maybe you ought to give me a kiss, Vetter. I always fancy a kiss when I'm getting my doodle pulled.
And then I think Crouch End's one of those thin places.
Silly, but I do have those thoughts. Too imaginative, I expect. My mother always said so anyway.
Did she indeed?
Yes.
Do you know what else I think?
No, sir, not a clue.
Highgate's mostly all right, that's what I think. It's just as thick as you'd want between us and the dimensions in Muswell Hill and Highgate. But now you take Archway and Finsbury Park. They border on Crouch End too. I've got friends in both places, and they know of my interest in certain things that don't seem to be any way rational. Certain crazy stories which have been told, we'll say, by people with nothing to gain by making up crazy stories. Did it occur to you to wonder, Farnham, why the woman would have told us the things she did if they weren't true?
Well,
Better struck a match and looked at Farnham over it. Pretty young woman, 26, two kiddies back at her hotel, husband's a young lawyer doing well in Milwaukee or someplace. What's she got to gain by coming in and spouting about the sort of things you only used to see in Emma films?
I don't know, Farnham said stiffly. But there may be an
So I say to myself,
Better overrode him,
that if there are such things as thin spots, this one would begin at Archway and Finsbury Park. But the very thinnest part is here at Crouch End. And I say to myself, wouldn't it be a day if the last of the leather between us and what's on the inside of that ball just rubbed away? Wouldn't it be a day if even half of what that woman told us was true?
Farnham was silent. He had decided that P.C. Vetter probably also believed in palmistry
and phrenology and the Rosicrucians. "Read the back file," Vetter said, getting up. There was a crackling sound as he put his hands in the small of his back and stretched.
"I'm going out to get some fresh air."
He strolled out. Farnham looked after him with a mixture of amusement and resentment. Vetter was dotty, all right. He was also a bloody fag mooch. Fags didn't come cheap in this brave new world of socialism and the welfare state. He picked up Vetter's notebook and began leafing through the girl's story again. And, yes, he would go through the back file. He would do it for laughs. The girl, or young woman, if he wanted to be politically correct, and all Americans did these days, it seemed, had burst into the station at 10:15 the previous evening, her hair in damp strings around her face, her eyes bulging. She was dragging her purse by the strap.
"Lonnie," she said. "Please, you've got to find Lonnie."
"Well, we'll do our best, won't we?" Vetter said. "But you've got to tell us who Lonnie is."
"He's dead," the young woman said. "I know he is."
She began to cry. Then she began to laugh, to cackle, really. She dropped her purse in front of her. She was hysterical. The station was fairly deserted at that hour on a weeknight. Sergeant Raymond was listening to a Pakistani woman tell, with almost unearthly calm, how her purse had been nicked on Hillfield Avenue by a yob with a lot of football tattoos and a great coxcomb of blue hair. Vetter saw Farnham come in from the anteroom, where he had been taking down old posters. "Have you room in your heart for an unwanted child?" and putting up new ones. "6 rules for safe night cycling." Vetter waved Farnham forward, and Sergeant Raymond, who had looked once when he heard the American woman's semi-hysterical voice, back. Raymond, who liked breaking pickpockets' fingers like breadsticks,
"Oh, come on, mate,"
he'd say, if asked to justify this extra-legal proceeding,
"50 million wogs can't be wrong,"
was not the man for a hysterical woman.
"Lonnie," she shrieked. "Oh, please, they've got Lonnie."
The Pakistani woman turned toward the young American woman, studied her calmly for a moment, then turned back to Sergeant Raymond and continued to tell him how her purse had been snatched.
"Miss,"
P.C. Farnham began,
"what's going on out there?"
she whispered. Her breath was coming in quick pants. Farnham noticed there was a slight scratch on her left cheek. She was a pretty little hen, with nice bubs, small but pert, and a great cloud of auburn hair. Her clothes were moderately expensive. The heel had come off one of her shoes.
"What's going on out there?"
she repeated.
"Monsters!"
The Pakistani woman looked over again and smiled. Her teeth were rotten. The smile was gone like a conjurer's trick, and she took the lost and stolen property form Raymond was holding out to her.
"Get the lady a cup of coffee and bring it down to room 3, Vetter said. "Could you do with a cup of coffee, Mum?"
"Lonnie,"
she whispered.
"I know he's dead."
"Now, you just come along with old Ted Vetter, and we'll sort this out in a jiff," he said,
and helped her to her feet. She was still talking in a low, moaning voice when he led her away with one arm snugged around her waist. She was rocking unsteadily because of the broken shoe. Farnham got the coffee and brought it into room 3, a plain white cubicle furnished with a scarred table, 4 chairs, and a water cooler in the corner. He put the coffee in front of her.
"Here, Mum," he said. "This'll do you good. I've got sugars if..." "I can't drink it," she said. "I couldn't."
And then she clutched the porcelain cup, someone's long-forgotten souvenir of Blackpool, in her hands, as if for warmth. Her hands were shaking quite badly, and Farnham wanted to tell her to put it down before she slopped the coffee and scalded herself.
"I couldn't,"
she said again. Then she drank, still holding the cup two-handed, the way a child will hold his cup of broth. And when she looked at them, it was a child's look, simple, exhausted, appealing, and at bay, somehow. It was as if whatever had happened had somehow shocked her young, as if some invisible hand had swooped down from the sky and slapped the last 20 years out of her, leaving a child in grown-up American clothes in this small, white interrogation room in Crouch End.
Lani, she said. The monsters, she said. Will you help me? Will you please help me? Maybe he isn't dead. Maybe. I'm an American citizen, she cried suddenly.
And then, as if she had said something deeply shameful, she began to sob. Veta patted her shoulder.
There, Mum. I think we can help find your Lonnie. Your husband, is he?
Still sobbing, she nodded. Danny and Norma are back at the hotel with the sitter. They'll be sleeping, expecting him to kiss them when we come in.
Now, if you could just relax and tell us what happened.
And where it happened,
Farnham added. Veta looked up at him swiftly, frowning.
But that's just it, she cried. I don't know where it happened. I'm not even sure what happened, except that it was horrible.
Veta had taken out his notebook.
What's your name, Mum?
Doris Freeman. My husband is Leonard Freeman. We're staying at the Hotel Intercontinental. We're American citizens.
This time the statement of nationality actually seemed to steady her a little. She sipped her coffee and put the mug down. Farnham saw that the palms of her hands were quite red. You'll feel that later, dearie, he thought. Veta was drudging it all down in his notebook. Now he looked momentarily at P.C. Farnham, just an unobtrusive flick of the eyes.
Are you on holiday? He asked.
Yes. 2 weeks here and one in Spain. We were supposed to have a week in Barcelona. But this isn't helping find Lani. Why are you asking me these stupid questions?
Just trying to get the background, Mrs. Freeman, Farnham said.
Without really thinking about it, both of them had adopted low, soothing voices.
Now, you go ahead and tell us what happened. Tell it in your own words.
Why is it so hard to get a taxi in London?
She asked abruptly. Farnham hardly knew what to say, but Veta responded as if the question were utterly germane to the discussion.
Oh, hard to say, Mum. Tourists, partly. Why? Did you have trouble getting someone who'd take you out here to Crouch End?
Yes, she said. We left the hotel at 3 and came down to Foyle's bookshop. Is that Cambridge Circus?
Near to, Veta agreed. Lovely big bookshop, Mum, isn't it?
We had no trouble getting a cab from the Intercontinental. They were lined up outside. But when we came out of Foyle's, it was nothing. Finally, when one did stop, the driver just laughed and shook his head when Lani said we wanted to go to Crouch End.
Why, they can be right bastards about the suburbs, begging your pardon, Mum, Farnham said.
He even refused a pound tip,
Doris Freeman said, and a very American perplexity had crept into her tone. We waited for almost half an hour before we got a driver who said he'd take us. It was 5:30 by then, maybe 5:45. And that was when Lani discovered he'd lost the address. She clutched the mug again.
Who were you going to see? Veta asked.
A colleague of my husband's, a lawyer named John Squales. My husband hadn't met him, but their two firms were...
She gestured vaguely.
Affiliated?
Yes, I suppose. When Mr. Squales found out that we were going to be in London on vacation, he invited us to his home for dinner. Lani had always written him at his office, of course, but he had Mr. Squales' home address on a slip of paper. After we got in the cab, he discovered he'd lost it, and all he could remember was that it was in Crouch End. She looked at them solemnly. Crouch End. I think that's an ugly name, Veta said.
So, what did you do then?
She began to talk. By the time she'd finished, her first cup of coffee and most of another were gone, and P.C. Veta had filled up several pages of his notebook with his blocky, sprawling script. Lonnie Freeman was a big man, and hunched forward in the roomy back seat of the black cab so he could talk to the driver. He looked to her amazingly as he had when she'd first seen him at a college basketball game in their senior year, sitting on the bench, his knees somewhere up around his ears, his hands on their big wrists dangling between his legs. Only then he had been wearing basketball shorts and a towel slung around his neck, and now he was in a suit and tie. He had never gotten in many games, she remembered fondly, because he just wasn't that good. and he lost addresses. The cabbie listened indulgently to the tale of the lost address. He was an elderly man, impeccably turned out in a grey summer weight suit, the antithesis of the slouching New York cab driver. Only the checked wool cap on the driver's head clashed, but it was an agreeable clash. It lent him a touch of rakish charm. Outside, the traffic flowed endlessly past on Cambridge Circus. The theatre nearby announced that the Phantom of the Opera was continuing its apparently endless run.
"Well, I'll tell you what, Gov," the cabbie said. "I'll take you there to Crouch End, and we'll stop at a call box, and you check your governor's address, and off we go, right to the door."
"That's wonderful," Doris said, really meaning it.
They had been in London 6 days now, and she could not recall ever having been in a place where the people were kinder or more civilized.
"Thanks," Lonnie said, and sat back.
He put his arm around Doris and smiled.
"See? No problem."
"No thanks to you," she mock growled, and threw a light punch at his midsection.
"Right,"
the cabbie said. "Hey, ho for Crouch End."
It was late August, and a steady, hot wind rattled the trash across the roads and whipped at the jackets and skirts of the men and women going home from work. The sun was settling, but when it shone between the buildings, Doris saw that it was beginning to take on the reddish cast of evening. The cabbie hummed. She relaxed with Lonnie's arm around her. She had seen more of him in the last 6 days than she had all year, it seemed, and she was very pleased to discover that she liked it. She had never been out of America before, either, and she had to keep reminding herself that she was in England. She was going to Barcelona. Thousands should be so lucky. Then the sun disappeared behind a wall of buildings, and she lost her sense of direction almost immediately. Cab rides in London did that to you, she had discovered. The city was a great sprawling warren of roads and mews and hills and closes, even inns, and she couldn't understand how anyone could get around. When she had mentioned it to Lonnie the day before, he had replied that they got around very carefully. Hadn't she noticed that all the cabbies kept the London Street Finder tucked cosily away beneath the dash? This was the longest cab ride they'd taken. The fashionable section of town dropped behind them, in spite of that perverse going around in circles feeling. They passed through an area of monolithic housing developments that could have been utterly deserted for all the signs of life they showed. No, she corrected herself, to Vetta and Farnham in the small white room. She had seen one small boy sitting on the curb striking matches. Then an area of small, rather tatty-looking shops and fruit stalls, and then, no wonder driving in London was so disorienting to out-of-towners, they seemed to have driven smack into the fashionable section again. There was even a McDonald's, she told Vetta and Farnham, in a tone of voice usually reserved for references to the Sphinx and the Hanging Gardens.
Was there?
Vetta replied, properly amazed and respectful. She had achieved a kind of total recall, and he wanted nothing to break the mood, at least until she had told them everything she could. The fashionable section with McDonald's as its centrepiece dropped away. They came briefly into the clear, and now the sun was a solid orange ball sitting above the horizon, washing the streets with a strange light that made all the pedestrians look as if they were about to burst into flame.
"It was then that things began to change," she said.
Her voice had dropped a little. Her hands were trembling again. Vetta leaned forward, intent.
"Changed? How? How did things change, Mrs. Freeman?"
They had passed a newsagent's window, she said, and the signboard outside had read, 60 lost in underground horror.
"Lonnie, look at that!"
"What?"
He craned around, but the newsagent was already behind them.
"It said, 60 lost in underground horror. Isn't that what they call the subway, the underground?"
"Yes. That or the tube. Was it a crash?"
"I don't know."
She leaned forward.
"Driver, do you know what that was about? Was there a subway crash?"
"A collision, mum? Not that I know of."
"Do you have a radio?"
"Not in the cab, mum."
"Lonnie?"
"Hmm?"
But she could see that Lonnie had lost interest. He was going through his pockets again, and because he was wearing his three-piece suit, there were a lot of them to go through. Having another hunt for the scrap of paper with John Squale's address written on it. The message chalked on the board played over and over in her mind. 60 killed in tube crash, it should have read. But 60 lost in underground horror. It made her uneasy. It didn't say killed. It said lost. The way news reports in the old days had always referred to sailors who had been drowned at sea. Underground horror. She didn't like it. It made her think of graveyards, sewers, and flabby, pale, noisome things swarming suddenly out of the tubes themselves, wrapping their arms, tentacles maybe, around the hapless commuters on the platforms, dragging them away to darkness. They turned right. Standing on the corner beside their parked motorcycles were three boys in leathers. They looked up at the cab, and for a moment, the setting sun was almost full in her face from this angle. It seemed that the bikers did not have human heads at all. For that one moment she was nastily sure that the sleek heads of rats sat atop those black leather jackets, rats with black eyes staring at the cab. Then the light shifted just a tiny bit, and she saw, of course, she had been mistaken. They were only three young men smoking cigarettes in front of the British version of the American candy store. "Here we go," Lonnie said, giving up the search and pointing out of the window. They were passing a sign which read, "Crouch Hill Road." Elderly brick houses like sleepy dowagers had closed in, seeming to look down at the cab from their blank windows. A few kids passed back and forth, riding bikes or trikes. Two others were trying to ride a skateboard with no notable success. Fathers home from work sat together, smoking and talking and watching the children. It all looked reassuringly normal. The cab drew up in front of a dismal-looking restaurant, with a small spotted sign in the window reading, "Fully Licensed," and a much larger one in the centre, which informed that within one could purchase curries to take away. On the inner ledge there slept a gigantic grey cat. Beside the restaurant was a call box.
"Here you are, Gov," the cab driver said. "You find your friend's address, and I'll track him down."
"Fair enough," Lonnie said, and got out.
Doris sat in the cab for a moment, and then also emerged, deciding she felt like stretching her legs. The hot wind was still blowing. It whipped her skirt around her knees, and then plastered an old ice cream wrapper to her shin. She removed it with a grimace of disgust. When she looked up, she was staring directly through the plate glass window at the big grey Tom. It stared back at her, one-eyed and inscrutable. Half of its face had been all but clawed away in some long-ago battle. What remained was a twisted, pinkish mass of scar tissue, one milky cataract, and a few tufts of hair. It meowed at her silently through the glass. Feeling a surge of disgust, she went to the call box and peered in through one of the dirty panes. Lonnie made a circle at her with his thumb and forefinger and winked. Then he pushed 10 pence into the slot and talked with someone. He laughed soundlessly through the glass, like the cat. She looked over for it, but now the window was empty. In the dimness beyond, she could see chairs up on tables and an old man pushing a broom. When she looked back, she saw that Lonnie was jotting something down. He put his pen away, held the paper in his hand. She could see an address was jotted on it, said one or two other things, then hung up and came out. He waggled the address at her in triumph.
"Okay, that's the..."
His eyes went past her shoulder and he frowned.
"Where's the stupid cab gone?"
She turned around. The taxi had vanished. Where it had stood there was only curbing and a few papers blowing lazily up the gutter. Across the street, two kids were clutching at each other and giggling. Doris noticed that one of them had a deformed hand. It looked more like a claw. She thought the National Health was supposed to take care of things like that. The children looked across the street, saw her observing them, and fell into each other's arms, giggling again.
"I don't know," Doris said.
She felt disoriented and a little stupid. The heat, the constant wind that seemed to blow with no gusts or drops, the almost painted quality of the light.
"What time was it then?"
Farnham asked suddenly.
"I don't know,"
Doris Freeman said, startled out of her recital.
"6, I suppose. Maybe 20 past. I see. Go on, Barnum said, knowing perfectly well that in August, sunset would not have begun, even by the loosest standards, until well past 7.
Well, what did he do?
Lonnie asked, still looking around. It was almost as if he expected his irritation to cause the cab to pop back into view.
Just pick up and leave?
Maybe when you put your hand up, Doris said, raising her own hand and making the thumb and forefinger circle Lonnie had made in the call box.
Maybe when you did that, he thought you were waving him on. I'd have to wave a long time to send him on with 2 and 5 on the meter,
Lonnie grunted, and walked over to the curb. On the other side of Crouch Hill Road, the 2 small children were still giggling.
Hey, Lonnie called. You kids!
You an American, sir?
The boy with the claw hand called back.
Yeah,
Lonnie said, smiling.
Did you see the cab over here? Did you see where it went?
The 2 children seemed to consider the question. The boy's companion was a girl of about 5, with untidy brown braids sticking off in opposite directions. She stepped forward to the opposite curb, formed her hands into a megaphone, and still smiling, she screamed it through her megaphoned hands and her smile. She cried at them,
"Bugger off, Joe!"
Lonnie's mouth dropped open.
"Sir! Sir! Sir!"
the boy screeched, saluting wildly with his deformed hand. Then the 2 of them took to their heels and fled around the corner and out of sight, leaving only their laughter to echo back. Lonnie looked at Doris, dumbstruck.
"I guess some of the kids in Crouch End aren't too crazy about Americans," he said lamely.
She looked around nervously. The street now appeared deserted. He slipped an arm around her.
"Well, kid, looks like we hike." "I'm not sure I want to. Those 2 kids might have gone to get their big brothers."
She laughed to show it was a joke, but there was a shrill quality to the sound. The evening had taken on a surreal quality she didn't much like. She wished they had stayed at the hotel.
"Not much else we can do," he said. "The street's not exactly overflowing with taxis, is it?"
"Lonnie, why would the cab driver leave us here like that? He seemed so nice."
"Don't have the slightest idea. But John gave me good directions. He lives in a street called Brass End, which is a very minor dead-end street, and he said it wasn't in the Street Finder."
As he talked, he was moving her away from the call box, from the restaurant that sold curries to take away, from the now empty curb. They were walking up Crouch Hill Road again.
"We take a right onto Hillfield Avenue, left halfway down, then our first right..." Or was it left? "Anyway, onto Petrie Street. Second left is Brass End."
"And you remember all that?"
"I'm a star witness," he said bravely. And she just had to laugh.
Lonnie had a way of making things seem better. There was a map of the Crouch End area on the wall of the police station lobby, one considerably more detailed than the one in the London Street Finder. Farnham approached it and studied it with his hands stuffed into his pockets. The station seemed very quiet now. Vetter was still outside, clearing some of the witch moss from his brains, one hoped, and Raymond had long since finished with the woman who'd had her purse nicked. Farnham put his finger on the spot where the cabbie had most likely let them off, if anything about the woman's story was to be believed, that was. The route to their friend's house looked pretty straightforward. Crouch Hill Road, to Hillfield Avenue, then a left onto Vickers Lane, followed by a left onto Petrie Street. Brass End, which stuck off from Petrie Street like somebody's afterthought, was no more than 6 or 8 houses long, about a mile all told. Even Americans should have been able to walk that far without getting lost.
"Raymond," he called.
"You still here?"
Sergeant Raymond came in. He had changed into streets and was zipping up a light poplin wind cheater.
"Only just, my beardless darling."
"Cut it,"
Barnum said, smiling all the same. Raymond frightened him a little. One look at the spooky sod was enough to tell you he was standing a little too close to the fence that ran between the yard of the good guys and that of the villains. There was a twisted white line of scar running like a fat string from the left corner of his mouth, almost all the way to his Adam's apple.
He claimed a pickpocket had once nearly cut his throat with a jagged bit of bottle. Claimed that's why he broke their fingers. Farnham thought that was the shit. He thought Raymond broke their fingers because he liked the sound they made, especially when they popped at the knuckles.
"Got a fag?"
Raymond asked. Farnham sighed and gave him one. As he lit it, he asked, "Is there a curry shop on Crouch Hill Road?"
"Not to my knowledge, my dearest darling," Raymond said.
"That's what I thought.
Got a problem, dear?"
"No," Farnham said, a little too sharply, remembering Doris Freeman's clotted hair and staring eyes.